From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Michael Waltrip won the 2001 Daytona 500. Tomorrow, he will drive in homage to Dale Earnhardt Sr., who died in that race's last lap 10 years ago. Ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with Michael Waltrip. Also, Tim Kirkchen has all the good spring training talk, and Sports Illustrated's Grant Wall declares his candidacy for president of FIFA. Also ahead, Mickey Ward reflects on his boxing past and whether the fighter stands a fighter's chance at the Academy Awards.
People got to see like what my background was a little bit, how things were in my life, like to overcome, to get where I got, because when people watched me fight, they didn't realize the things I was dealing with outside the ring. I think that's what it showed people.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Can it be that the crack of the bat is about to replace the scrape of the snow shovel? Well, no, nobody who lives north of Florida or east of Arizona will be fooled by the fact that spring training is underway. There will be more shoveling and scraping and plows plowing us back in. But the mere idea of baseball happening somewhere is sustaining, at least for me, and I'm sure for Tim Kirkchen, who joins me now from the aforementioned Arizona. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be here, Bill. Thank you.
Albert Pujols reported to the Cardinals training camp on Thursday St. Louis had failed to present an extension offer that he found acceptable before the Wednesday deadline, so he will apparently play out the last year of his contract and become a free agent after this season. What were his demands, and should the Cardinals have met them?
Well, his demands and the Cardinals asking were just so far apart, and they kept the negotiations so secretive that we're still not exactly sure who offered what and when. The only thing Albert would say was, most of you guys were way off on this. The bottom line is this. The Cardinals obviously didn't offer enough to make him happy, given that he is, by any statistical measure, the best player in the game. Albert's group is saying, we're not going to negotiate at all until November, so it's possible this will be 8 months in the making, and then we'll see if the Cardinals have what it takes in November. And then, of course, when other teams get involved, the whole equation changes.
The Tampa Bay Rays were the best American League team in the regular season, and yet they've acquired some veteran help in the persons of Manny Ramirez and Johnny Damon. Will their postseason experience be enough to bring the coveted Commissioner's Trophy to Florida?
I don't see it, Bill. I mean, they lost eight key players on their team from last year, including Carl Crawford, including their closer and their top setup guy. They have to rebuild their entire bullpen. They traded Matt Garza, who's one of their two best starting pitchers. They have a lot of work to do. And even though I think Johnny Damon and Manny Ramirez can help them offensively, they have a long way to go with that club. But it is going to be fun to watch, especially watching Joe Maddon deal with Manny Ramirez and see how that goes. Keep in mind, Joe Maddon is the guy who, in a complete sentence during the World Series, used the word intrinsic and ameliorate in the same sentence. I'm not sure Manny knows what either one of those means, but the communication there should be fun to watch.
There's a possibility sitting up there like a volleyball, and I'm not going to hit it.
It's too easy, Bill. And then in the next sentence, he used the word intuitive. So, again, I think we're way over Manny's skis at this point.
All right, you mentioned Carl Crawford. He, of course, will be playing in Boston this year, which should be kind of fun for Red Sox fans. What other offseason free agent signings do you find intriguing?
Well, I find the whole Red Sox situation to be fascinating because not only did they get Carl Crawford, but they traded for Adrian Gonzalez, who is a tremendous player who's gone completely under the radar because he's played in that huge Petco Park with the Padres. Now you get him to Fenway Park, which is the absolute perfect fit of a player's swing to a ballpark. He's going to hit 50 doubles in that place. He's going to hit at least 30 homers, and he's going to give them a first baseman and middle-of-the-order hitter that they needed last year. Now, the question is, are they going to pitch enough? But they got their offense fixed with Carl Crawford and Adrian Gonzalez in the offseason.
The New York the San Francisco Giants won it all last year. The Texas Rangers were the runners-up. Are those teams well set up to get to the World Series again?
I think so. I'm not suggesting either one of them is going to repeat, because repeating is so difficult these days. But the Giants still have tremendous pitching, and it should be even better this year than it was last year. But they didn't do anything else to really upgrade their team, and you really have to do that. I think the Rangers are still good enough to win their division, but they lost Vlad Guerrero, who knocked in 115 runs, and more important, they lost Cliff Lee, who just carried them down the stretch the last 2 months. So they've got some work to do, but I think both of those teams will make the playoffs. Getting back to the World Series, I'm not so sure about that.
You don't think the Giants can just grow longer beards and count on that?
I spoke to Brian Wilson at length this spring, the guy with the very long, very dark beard. He is as unique a baseball player as I've ever met, but he is really, really smart. He may be a bit contrived, but he is a brilliant young man.
Can he say intrinsic in a complete sentence?
No, he used some other words. He used the word dude 3 times in about 2 sentences. Slightly different conversation.
Tim, Cincinnati took the National League Central last season. A pleasant surprise to their fans. Are the Reds going to continue playing well in 2011?
I think so. Some of my writer friends think the Reds were a bit of a mirage last year. I totally disagree. I just saw them a few days ago in Arizona, and they have essentially the entire team back from last year. Their young pitching, which was really good the second half of the year, should be even better this year because they've got some experience for their young guys, they've got improved health, and all those guys are going to be in the starting rotation from day one as opposed to last year where they kept showing up every other month. I really like that club. Plus, they led the league in runs scored last year, and that whole offense is back, led by Joey Votto, who's the reigning NL MVP.
For many years, of course, you have opined, and I'm quoting now, that the Yankees are still the Yankees, but are the Yankees still the Yankees this year?
I'm starting to wonder, Bill. I have till April 1 to completely jump off the bandwagon. And I'm saying this might be the year that I do, that I acknowledge the Yankees aren't the Yankees anymore, but I need a month to figure that out.
But it's still fair to celebrate the beauty of baseball, right?
We do that every single day with something. Today, Bill, I saw a guy with the Angels who's 7'1", and he's a pitcher. He's from the Netherlands, and I had a long chat with him, and I think it was the greatest disparity in height ever between a writer and a baseball player. 5'5", and I'm being generous, and 7'1".
Tim Kirkjian is a reporter for ESPN's Baseball Tonight and a senior writer for ESPN the magazine. And, of course, he joins me every once in a while during the baseball season, this time on the line from Arizona. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
When asked how women's soccer should be promoted, FIFA President Sepp Blatter, the head of the sport's governing body, suggested, quote, tighter shorts. Homosexuality is illegal in Qatar, the site of the 2022 World Cup, and so Mr. Blatter said gays and lesbians attending the festivities should, quote, refrain from any sexual activity. Mr. Blatter is currently campaigning for his fourth term as president of FIFA. Grant Wall, who writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated and SportsIllustrated.com, has announced his candidacy as well. Mr. Wall's campaign on the streets of New York has sounded something like this.
Hi, I'm Grant Wall. I'm running for FIFA president.
You're running for who?
FIFA president. You know what FIFA is?
No. What is FIFA?
It's the world governing body of soccer, and I want to run the whole thing.
Congratulations.
I appreciate your support.
I wish you good luck.
Thank you.
Grant Wall joins me now on the line. That woman to whom you introduced yourself sounded very supportive of your candidacy, but can she help you win?
Well, that's the problem. It was wonderful talking with ordinary folks on the street, some of whom, like her, had no idea what FIFA actually is. Unfortunately, the ordinary folks can't vote for FIFA president. Mm. The election is going to be June 1st, and Sepp Blatter, who's been there for 13 years, is running for his fourth term, so far unopposed. He ran unopposed last time. So that's why I announced my candidacy. I want to feel like I represent the world soccer fans, but the actual election will be one vote per national soccer federation that's a member of FIFA.
Well, okay, I understand that you've entered this race for the most high-minded of reasons, Grant, but I'm going to accuse you of negative campaigning. You're coming out with slogans like Stop the Bladder Infection.
That's low-hanging fruit, I have to admit. But that's the amazing thing, is that FIFA is so screwed up at this point that it's really easy to campaign against them. It's really like shooting fish in a barrel. Sepp Blatter, the guy who runs FIFA, has come out against instant replay. He's come out against goal line technology so that we could just know if the ball crosses the line. Even corruption has been a problem in FIFA. Two of the voters for the World Cup in December were suspended and couldn't vote because they were caught trying to sell their votes. And Blatter has presided over all of this. One of my campaign promises is to go WikiLeaks on FIFA, and once I'm president, I'll release all the internal documents to the public.
Do you sense that Sepp Blatter is running scared?
No. Probably not. I think it's possible he is completely unaware of my candidacy.
Well, not after this show goes on the air, by golly.
But, you know, that's okay. You know, I think it's kind of good, though, even if we can have some fun with this, to kind of put a spotlight on FIFA and the fact that there's some real issues there and things that probably should change. And it'd be great if somebody else decided to run against Blatter as well.
All right. Now, I understand that you don't even get to vote for yourself because of the way FIFA works. But if you did win, what would be your agenda for change within FIFA? What would you do first week in office?
Well, one of the things I would do is make sure all the internal documents from FIFA were made public so we could take a look at what really goes on there. This is an organization that has never had its Salt Lake City moment like the IOC did with the corruption involved in that Olympic bid. But also, too, it's a very male-dominated organization at FIFA, and the all-powerful 24-man executive committee is exactly that. It's all men. So the first thing I would do is appoint a female general secretary, which is the most powerful appointed position at FIFA. And also, there's just some basic things about the game itself, whether it's instant replay for balls that are on the goal line to make sure they're in or out. I think it's the dumbest thing ever that players get yellow cards after they score a goal for removing their jersey to celebrate. It's the same punishment that a Dutch player got for karate kicking one of the Spanish players in the chest during the World Cup final. It doesn't seem like quite the same thing.
Well, you've convinced me, Grant. You've got my vote. But, oh, wait a minute. I don't have a vote either.
Exactly. So, you know, right now what I've got to do is convince one federation from some country in this world to nominate me in writing by April 1st. Mm. And if that happens, I can actually take on Sepp Blatter in the FIFA presidential election.
And FIFA is very wide-ranging. I mean, it could be a tiny country somewhere, right?
It could be anything. It could be a tiny African country, something in Southeast Asia. It could even be the U.S., though they tend to support Blatter. That's a long story.
Grant Wall is only a game's choice for next president of FIFA, although my understanding is that he hasn't quit his day job with Sports Illustrated quite yet. Grant, thanks very much. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thanks, Bill.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. On Sunday, anticipating Valentine's Day, 14 couples gathered on a beach in Thailand. At 6 a.m., somebody blew a whistle or something, and each of the couples began to kiss. 34 minutes later, the least determined of the couples dropped out of a kissing competition designed to set a new world record for same. Mere hours later, another couple fell apart. "I could not make it anymore because my neck is hurting," said Amporn Ketmao. More determined and better conditioned were Laksana Tiranarat and her husband, who sustained their kiss for 46 hours, 24 minutes, and 9 seconds, thus breaking the world record and winning a diamond ring and $4,000.
Starving for your kisses. Starving for your kisses.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, on the eve of the 2011 Daytona 500, Michael Waltrip recalls the 2001 edition of that race, which he won. But first, The Fighter, starring Mark Wahlberg, Christian Bale, Amy Adams, and Melissa Leo, has been nominated for half a dozen Academy Awards. Let's hear what a guy familiar with the script thinks of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it was really good. It was really, I mean, obviously, you know, in a movie, they make things, they don't make things up, but they make things more dramatized and you know, things like that. But I was happy with the way the movie came out.
Mickey Ward, film critic, winner of 38 professional bouts and loser of 13, is the guy upon whose life The Fighter is based. And boxing was only part of what made Ward's story attractive to Hollywood. His half-brother, Dickie Eklund, an ex-fighter himself and Mickey's sometime trainer, has struggled with drug addiction. He's been in and out of prison. Ward's mother managed much of his career, and his seven sisters by turns supported, distracted, and embarrassed the boxer as he tried to concentrate on his trade. At one dramatic moment in the film, Mickey, played by Mark Wahlberg, steps between the feuding camps of his girlfriend and his family.
He's a junk bag.
Why am I the problem? I'm his blood. I'm his family.
I'm the one fighting, okay? Not you, not you, and not you. I know what I need.
And you need Dickie?
I want Dickie back. And I want you, Charlene, and I want O'Keefe. I want my family. What's wrong with that?
Wahlberg is convincing as Mickey Ward, but Mickey himself feels that the folks who nominated Christian Bale for Best Supporting Actor based on his portrayal of Dickie Eklund knew what they were doing.
It could be, you know, it's just unfortunate that Mark played my character that's more laid back and, you know, more ain't as crazy as Dickie's, you know. And Mark, you know, I just feel bad that Mark didn't get to play that nutty guy, you know. But, I mean, it is what it is, but Christian, I'm telling you, he's a very nice person, and he's a great actor. He nailed it.
In one of Bale's more athletic scenes, he jumps from the second-story window of a crack house rather than get caught in the place by members of his family. I asked Mickey Ward if Dickie was okay with that scene.
Oh, yeah, he was great. He was good with it. It was funny when we first went out to L.A. to see it the first time. Me, Mark, and Christian. Me, Mark, and Dickie were sitting up in the back. Christian and his wife were in the front out in L.A. in that theater at Paramount Pictures, and we're looking at Dickie making faces when the people jumped out of the window. So I was, why, that didn't happen? I says to him. He goes, yeah, it would happen. But I went out the third floor, not the second, and there was no barrels underneath me. I was like, oh, wow, I go, okay. So you proud of that? And he says, no, I'm not.
According to Mickey, Dickie is currently, quote, doing okay. He's working with youngsters in the gym Mickey co-owns, staying sober, taking it one day at a time. Which is not to say Mickey is completely free of resentment regarding his half-brother. It was Dickie, after all, who fouled up the cameos director David Russell tried to give them in The Fighter.
Me and Dickie were, David O. Russell gave us like two paragraphs apiece to play. We're going to play a person on the street. And so it gives me my script and Dickie his script. So I look at it and I go, okay. So I got to go home and study it. Dickie looks at it and goes, I wouldn't say this. David goes, Dickie, it's not you. You're a person from the street of Lowell talking about yourself. You're not you. He goes, I don't care. This person shouldn't say that. He goes, Dickie, it's a movie. Dickie goes, well, this person is crazy. He shouldn't say that. It's not you, Dickie. You got to remember, Dickie, it's a person from the street. Dickie goes, I don't want to do it.
So that was that, and Dickie Eklund took his half-brother's acting career down with his own?
Yeah, it did. It did, but I'm a fighter, and I'm going to come back.
It is a good and even a great thing that Mickey Ward can laugh about Dickie's most recent act of sabotage. In the movie, Dickie is portrayed as a crafty but thoroughly undependable corner man, a guy who can't even be counted on to show up at the gym sober and on time. According to Bob Halloran, with whom I spoke in 2007 regarding his Mickey Ward biography, Irish Thunder, that portrayal is true to the relationship Mickey Ward tolerated for years.
I don't have any specific details of Dickie being messed up on drugs or something when he was in the corner, but Mickey did say there were times when he couldn't understand what Dickie was saying.
As he got to know Mickey Ward and became more aware of the volatile circumstances of his home life, Halloran developed tremendous respect for Ward's determination.
I don't know where Mickey gets his moral center. I really don't. It's not in his family. No offense to his family. It's not in the boxing community where there's so much, corruption and things like that. I don't think he's naive. I think he knows what goes on around him. One of the greatest things I can say about him is that he is just so focused on success and hard work. He'll just do the work. You guys can, you know, do your business on the outside. You can steal the money. You can do whatever you want. I'm just working. I'm in the gym. And when it comes to the fight night, I'm going to be in the ring with that guy, and I'm going to do what I do. And I think he lets the chips fall to the side.
In The Fighter, Mark Wahlberg is convincing as the determined and ultimately triumphant Mickey Ward, but verisimilitude requires that Ward's sisters be portrayed as obstacles to the fighter's career, and loud, drunken, obnoxious obstacles at that. Before he saw the film, Ward said that he knew that if he was going to watch it in the company of his sisters, he'd better wear his boxing headgear. A bit of an exaggeration, as it turned out.
I went okay. I mean, some liked it, some didn't like it. Some got up and walked out, some stood. Some threw some F-bombs around as they were walking out at me. Not really at me.
Did they blame you?
No. They didn't blame me at all. They didn't blame me whatsoever. They were just upset that the way they were portrayed and, with the high hair and the craziness. I mean, they were crazy in their own way, but they didn't have high hair like that. That didn't make them look too good.
As Mickey puts it, there is still no love lost between his sisters and his wife, Charlene. But except for that unhappy circumstance, Mickey Ward seems to be doing pretty well for himself. His businesses include a tanning salon, an indoor floor hockey facility, and the aforementioned gym. He's looking forward to attending the Academy Awards ceremony a week from Sunday. He'd love to see the actors and director he's gotten to know honored for their work, and he figures The Fighter has at least an underdog's chance to be named Best Picture. But even if it doesn't win, the making of the movie and the attendant publicity have become important parts of Mickey Ward's post-boxing life.
It's opened up a lot of different avenues as far as a lot of speaking stuff I do, some business stuff, things like that. People got to see what my background was a little bit in somewhat fashion, how things were in my life, to overcome, to get where I got. Because when people watched me fight, they didn't realize the things I was dealing with outside the ring. And for people to see that, and for younger fighters or anybody in any sport life, to see you can go through turmoil and, some family drama and stuff, and you can still make it as long as you keep your heart and your mind in it, and you just believe in yourself, you can make it, and I think that's what it showed people.
Mickey Ward, now 45, last fought in 2003. His recent brush with the glitter and glamour of Hollywood notwithstanding, he continues to reside in Lowell, Massachusetts. 10 years ago this week, Michael Waltrip won the Daytona 500, the race in which legendary driver Dale Earnhardt died. Waltrip was driving for Earnhardt's team. Before winning that race, Waltrip had driven in 462 NASCAR events without finishing first. Waltrip's win and Earnhardt's death are at the center of In the Blink of an Eye, subtitled Dale Daytona and the Day That Changed Everything, which Michael Waltrip recently wrote with the assistance of Ellis Hennekin. Michael Waltrip, who incidentally on Thursday posted the 8th fastest qualifying time for tomorrow's Daytona 500, joins me now from Daytona. Welcome to Only a Game.
I appreciate it, Bill. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Like Dale Earnhardt Jr., you come from a racing family. As you look back at the road you took into the sport, does your career choice seem to you inevitable?
Oh, certainly. From the time I've been on this earth, my brother Daryl was off racing a car. He was 16 years old when I was born, so I grew up chasing him around. Mom and Dad would throw me in the back of the family car, and we would be off to the races, and it just was how I grew up, and it's all I really ever thought of. I did feel like maybe that I was a little naive as a 10 or 12-year-old kid telling everybody I was going to be a race car driver, because I noticed there weren't too many of those around town, but I wanted to be like my brother, and that was my whole focus as a kid.
What do you think the response of your family members would have been if you'd said at 12, I want to be a doctor?
They would have said, you're going to probably need to do better at school. And I wanted to be a weatherman, too. That was my other career opportunity. And then somebody clued me in that you had to go to college for that as well.
You credit Dale Earnhardt with giving you the opportunity to succeed as a driver. You had run an awful lot of races without winning. What do you suppose he saw in you?
Well, we were buddies, and, he knew how passionate I was about racing. And the 0 for 462 thing, it was bad. No one will probably ever lose that many races again without winning one because they won't get the chance. But I knew I could win. I'd outrun Dale on occasions. Heck, I'd outrun everybody on occasions. I just couldn't outrun them all on the same day. He believed in his heart that if I ever got to drive a car for him, I would win. And that was sort of his motivation for picking me to drive his car.
Some observers have said that at that Daytona 500 10 years ago, Dale Earnhardt was blocking for you. For our listeners who may not be familiar with auto racing tactics and terms, what does blocking mean?
Well, at Daytona, you race in a pack. The cars are tied together aerodynamically because of the slipstream, the draft that comes off the vehicle you're following. On those types of tracks, you really need people to push you and to work with you. Dale and I talked on the Friday morning prior to that me, him, and Dale Jr. were going to be that team. We were going to be the three that tied it all together. As the laps wound down, the last 20 laps, I had put myself in the first position. Dale Earnhardt Jr. was second, and Dale was third. One thing that writing the book did for me is it made me realize how hard he worked blocking for those last 20 laps, but then when he crashed his car, he wasn't blocking anymore for us. Anybody that knows restrictor plate racing could look at the scenario and know that there was no way that anyone was going to pass me and Dale Jr. We had too big of a lead. We were already home free. He was just blocking and fighting for that third spot. He wanted a 1-2-3 finish is one theory maybe, and another is he thought maybe if he got in front of Sterling Marlin, who had a really fast car, he could drive up there and pass us both and make it be a 1-2-3 finish, but him being in front. So I was thankful that I went to the effort of writing the book because there was a lot of stuff that I had just decided to block out and try to forget, and that's not a great strategy in life. You should probably face things that hurt, and I was able to do that, and people really are seeming to enjoy the story, and I certainly enjoyed how I came out the other side of writing it.
On that day 10 years ago, you knew as soon as you crossed the finish line and took the checkered flag that you had won one of the sport's most prestigious races. How did you learn that Dale Earnhardt had crashed and that he hadn't survived that accident?
Well, when I took the checkered flag, I thought everything in the whole world was perfect. It just was the perfect place for me to be on what I thought was the perfect day. And then my buddy Kenny Schrader, who is a fellow race car driver, was actually in the accident with Dale. And when the cars came to a stop, Kenny went to check on Dale. And Kenny tells the story really, really well. He said, I went over there and he said, I knew Dale was going to be mad because he had wrecked on the last lap and he wasn't going to be happy. But, you know, I thought we would just laugh about the fact that we had crashed and that his team just won the Daytona 500. And when Kenny got there, Dale was hurt bad. And so Kenny came to Victory Lane probably a half hour after the conclusion of the race, as soon as he could get there, to tell me what had happened. And he just said, Mike, it's not good. Dale's hurt. I think Dale's hurt really bad.
In the book, you refer often to your faith. How did it help you to come to terms with Dale Earnhardt's death at Daytona?
Well, there's only one way to justify what happened, and that is, you know, I'm a Christian, and I believe that our days on earth are numbered, and I believe that when you die, you go to heaven. That's my faith. And if I didn't believe that, how could you explain why that all went down like that? You know, what could have possibly been the someone's reason for something being that cruel and that sad? So that's just how I deal with it. I've always dealt with it like that, but there's been times when I've certainly asked why, you know, why did it have to be that way, and why did I win our greatest race, and yet I don't even want to be associated with it. But I'll go to heaven one day, and I bet you I find out.
I'm speaking with NASCAR driver Michael Waltrip, and you're listening to Only a Game. As you point out in the book, at Daytona 10 years ago, Dale Earnhardt became the fourth driver to die in a crash in less than a year. Is auto racing safer now than it was 10 years ago?
We are so much more prepared to hit things now than we were back then. Since 2002, we've implemented the head and neck restraint device. We've put up safer barriers around the racetrack. NASCAR opened an R&D facility just outside of Charlotte where they study every crash and every car that's been crashed. They've installed crash data boxes inside the car to see what kind of G-forces the cars are generating when they hit the wall. So tons of things have happened over the last 10 years to make us safer inside the cars, and for that I'm thankful.
You spoke about what writing the book accomplished for you. Is there any significance to the fact that you've waited 10 years to tell the story of the 2001 Daytona 500?
Well, I'm not that bright, but I was able to figure out after the 9th anniversary of Dale's death that the 10th was going to be up next and that a lot of people were going to want to ask me about that day. And so for the first time, my sister Connie recorded all the races for me, and I knew where the DVD was for that race, but I just never put it in. All 4 hours of it, I just sat there and watched it, and I figured out, you know, obviously that Dale, the last thing he knew on earth is there we were going to win. Plus the media that week, Dale had told two or three different people that he was the happiest he'd ever been in his whole life. He was just really content with who he was and where he was. That's a great place to be too. That brought some comfort and relief to me as well. There was a lot of things that made me laugh and smile and made me feel more comfortable with talking about that day. Now, through the process of doing it, Ellis and I yelled at I yelled at Ellis a lot because I would tell something that was really emotionally challenging for me to tell him. And when I'd get done, he said, "Now tell me that again." And I said, "Ellis, I will hit you. I'm bigger than you are." And so, you know, we had a few reality show moments in the writing of the book, but he's the first person. I didn't know him from anything, and he's the first person that I brought up all the details and all the feelings I had about that race that day to. So he became not only a writer, but a bit of a doctor for me as well.
Michael Waltrip, the winning driver at the Daytona 500 10 years ago, now co-owns the Michael Waltrip Racing Team, and he will be one of that team's drivers this weekend at Daytona. With Ellis Hennekin, he wrote In the Blink of an Eye. Michael, thank you very much for speaking with me.
I appreciate being on. Thank you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life. summer.harvard.edu. And Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
It would be hard enough to set the record for world's longest hockey game under perfect conditions when unseasonably warm temperatures turned the ice to slush in Sherwood Park, Alberta. The task became considerably more difficult. The event, designed to raise money for the Alberta Cancer Foundation, began on February 11th, and it is supposed to last until February 21st, but warm weather has challenged the stamina of the players. Nor is the sun the only problem. According to event organizer Brent Sake, a Zamboni could break down, he said. And if a ref doesn't show up for his shift, there's no record. The last time anybody paid attention to the score, Team Blue had 1,410 goals to Team White's 1,091. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, more challenges for Jeopardy champ Watson. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
2 weeks before the collective bargaining agreement expires, the NFL and the Players Union have agreed to enter mediation. Do you think George H. Cohen of the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service will be able to do what no one has been able to do yet?
Well, I hope that he has a good idea of what he's walking into here, basically, because you've got one side with very large people, who many of whom don't really understand what the issues are at stake, and another side with very greedy people who really do. So we shall see.
The NBA All-Star Game will be played in Los Angeles tomorrow. You got the rosters in front of you. Who has the advantage, the East or the West?
Well, the interesting thing for me is the West team, which had to go out of its way to get Blake Griffin and Kevin Love, who are two of the players people actually really do want to see in the All-Star Game, onto the roster. So they managed to do that. So the West team, to me, is by far the more intriguing.
I had heard that the Los Angeles Lakers were beatable this season, and I guess the Cleveland Cavaliers, winners of only 9 games before they hosted L.A. on Wednesday night, had heard the same thing.
Yeah, that was a classic. Can we please get back to L.A. for the All-Star weekend where there are going to be lots of parties and we can have lots of fun, and do we have to play this game on the part of the Lakers? A completely explicable result if a completely inexplicable-looking score. And this was, after all, a team that the Lakers beat by 55 points when they really cared a little earlier this season.
The President of the United States said this week that somewhere in Boston there should be a statue of Bill Russell, to whom Mr. Obama had just awarded the Medal of Freedom. Do you have a suggestion concerning what that statue should look like and where it should stand?
Well, it should stand outside of what is now the TD North Garden. I think it should just be that incredible-looking walk from the bench with the slouched shoulders and the chin out and the goatee pointing north or whatever. And that classic thing of, oh, my goodness, I look like I'm such an old man and I'm going to eat your lunch for the next 15 minutes. And, of course, the extraordinary thing about doing this for Bill Russell is you're not entirely sure he wants it.
My ranking sheet says that Kansas is still the number one men's college basketball team in the country, but not when they play Kansas State, I guess.
No, Kansas State, which was supposed to have been a lot better than it has been this year, got Kansas in their own building and beat them by 16. There is no number one team in college basketball this year. There's no team that's clearly better than all the rest of them. This is example number 305 this year of that.
We had a story on the program recently about the success of the San Diego State men's college basketball team, Charlie, and I think it's fair to say the only a game jinx has failed to derail the Aztecs.
Yeah, they won their 26th game. They're supposed to be this year's Butler, by the way. However, I did watch them play BYU, and they're good, but they're not that good.
Last month, a lab in Turkey, where Diana Taurasi had been playing basketball, said that she had tested positive for a banned substance. The Turkish team terminated her contract. Doubts were raised about whether Taurasi would be able to play in the 2012 Olympic Games. But this week, the lab said, never mind. Do you agree with Taurasi's former employer that the lab owes more than an apology on this one?
The lab owes her ownership. She should own her own drug testing lab at this point. The owner of the Turkish team she was playing for has sworn that he will take, quote, every kind of legal action to the compensation of our losses.
Gary Sheffield, who played 22 seasons in the majors, announced his retirement this week and began campaigning for the Hall of Fame by suggesting that a lot of the players in there didn't belong. Good strategy, huh?
He's got 500 home runs and he hit .292. I mean, he's a marginal Hall of Famer, but you do not get into the Hall of Fame by suggesting that you might want to throw some people out first.
What's that guy Mays doing in
there?
Get
out of here.
I don't know how good the expansion MLS Vancouver Whitecaps
will be.
Scarves says Whitecaps right on it. I don't know how good whether they're going to be on the field, but is it safe to say that their preseason performance has been terrific?
They are apparently the leading sponsorship team in all of MLS, and I can't figure out why.
Because they haven't disappointed anybody yet.
Because they haven't played yet. This should tell MLS something. The best thing they could do was form a league that never plays. And if soccer were to do that generally, I'd be a happy guy, Bill.
Can we get somebody else to do this segment? I've had it with this. It's over. And finally, Charlie, I bring you the tale of Christian Herba, who's been seeking the world record for climbing 921 steps to the top of Europe's tallest hotel in 19 minutes. That's nearly twice as long as it took record holder Thomas Dold to climb the Empire State Building's 1,500 steps. So why does this guy think he has a record?
Because he was on a bicycle.
Ah.
Now think about riding a bike upstairs. Mr. Herba apparently bounces up two at a time, bounces his bike up. He doesn't really pedal because you couldn't really pedal. Otherwise, you'd need about 9,000 really teeny ramps.
How come you didn't say sports?
Because this is an athletic endeavor. He's on a bicycle. It's physical exertion. This isn't guys pulling fish out of the river. I mean, this is a real deal.
Only a game, thy name is arbitrary. Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among other books. He joins me each week at this time, of course, on Only a Game. Thank you,
Thanks,
Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
On three consecutive nights earlier this week, the IBM supercomputer nicknamed Watson beat Ken Jennings and Brad Rutter, Jeopardy's two most accomplished champions, by a final score of $77,147 to $24,000 and $21,600, respectively. IBM engineers proudly declared that the win marks the dawn of a new era in which computers will assume more and more human-like responsibilities. But not everyone is convinced. Only a Game's Karen Given is chief among the skeptics.
I've always known if my older brother John appeared on Jeopardy, he'd come home a winner. But earlier this week, watching as my brother's favorite television show turned into three 30-minute commercials for IBM, I started to lose hope. What's the point of cheering for a human champion when a computer can do this?
Watson.
Who is Franz Liszt?
You are right. Watson.
What is violin?
Good. Watson.
Who is Rachmaninoff?
Okay, I get it. Programming Watson to sift through the riddles, cultural references, and colloquialisms in the average Jeopardy answer was a triumph of human intelligence. I get it. But what if computers were allowed to play all our games? Watson, come on down? How anticlimactic would it be when the final showcase was revealed and Watson quickly calculated the actual retail value? Oh, wait. That really happened with a guy named Terry Neese in 2008. Okay, well, let's take this conversation to something a little more sporty, shall we? If the relatively clunky computer in the arcade video game can win races, why couldn't a supercomputer drive a stock car to victory in NASCAR?
Turn left. Shift. Turn left.
There would be no fear, no fatigue, no emotions getting in the way of making the right move. Watson, or maybe his name would be Junior, would win the Sprint Cup Championship year after year after year. Kind of like Jimmy Johnson did in 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, and 2010. Okay, maybe one man or machine who does something better than anyone else isn't the end of the world as we know it. But there has to be at least one human competition in which smarts and steel do not outweigh human ingenuity.
That's right, it's Winter Wipeout.
I can picture it now. IBM's engineers strap skis onto Watson's smug and annoyingly swirly avatar screen and send him on his way down the slide.
Oh no. Dear Lord, help.
I feel better already.
Twice a month, the Thursday Night Fishing Club celebrates the angler's art at a restaurant on the old Mandrell family estate in Tennessee called Fontanelle. Die-hard fishermen, old-time country music fans, and lovers of farm-to-fork southern cooking school up at feeding time to sample the chef's fish special and catch the floor show. The house band reels in Grand Old Opry greats to sing along and spin a few yarns. Only a Game's Kim Green weighs in.
Dear Only a Game, I never thought this would happen to me. 2 years ago, you sent me to the Women's Bassmaster Tour, and I caught a fish. It was a fantasy come true.
You do have a fish on.
I do. It's a fish.
Yes.
I thought I was caught.
I thought you did. I didn't even know. There. You go, girl. See?
I got hooked. And now, here I am in White's Creek, Tennessee, with a room full of fellow fish lovers, limiting out on a plate full of trout. Meanwhile, the Thursday Night Fishing Club band churns out pescatorial hits.
Yeah, the Papa was a fishing man. Papa was a fishing man. Loved his cars and his steel guitar. Papa was a fishing man. Ooh, yeah, fishing man.
Singer-songwriter and dedicated angler Gary Schiebler has been singing and recording fishing songs for almost 10 years. He says fishing and making music go hand in hand. But when I ask him what the connection is, he initially flounders.
Well, I'm not sure. That's. See, you got me. You stumped me completely. I'm speechless. For a New Yorker, that's impossible. But let me think about that. What is this? So repeat the question to me. Maybe if you repeat the question to me, I'll come up with something.
What is the connection between fishing and music?
I still don't know.
Actually, it's pretty clear what the connection is for Schiebler. He loves songwriting and performing, and he loves long, lazy days wetting a line in lakes or streams. He's not alone. Lots of Nashville musicians have doubled as anglers, or vice versa. Greats like Mel Tillis and Bobby Bear.
Take me out on the water, put a fishing rod in my hand. Take me out on the water, put a fishing rod in my hand.
Schiebler spawned this bi-monthly event in January at the Farmhouse Restaurant at Fontenelle. He's already lured Bobby Bear and a few other Opry Star fishermen to play a set or two. Schiebler hopes they'll chum the water for old-school country fans who want to hear their heroes work a small room.
Thank you all for being here. Hope you enjoy it.
As Opry legend Jan Howard takes the stage, a sea of faces lights up, feet and fingers tap, and a few couples start two-stepping.
Hit me a B-flat. Well, my heart skips a beat when we walk.
Howard's an angler, for applause. For trout, not so much. A veteran outdoorswoman, she loves snow skiing, golfing, and flying small planes, but she's never been fishing.
When I left the Ozarks, I got married when I was barely 15. And I had more things to do. I had three little boys before I was 21, and I had more things to do than think about going fishing.
The energetic 80-year-old says she's willing to give it a try, but she didn't come here for the fishing. For her, the night is a throwback to 50 years ago, when she once visited the Mandrells as a young singer-songwriter. A time when fellow artists used to gather for an intimate evening of music-making and camaraderie.
And that's when friends got together. And of course, most of our friends were all musicians, artists, whatever. And you come to the house and everybody just naturally sit around, pick and sing. And that's what she did.
Even the food here seems to evoke a bygone era. Farmhouse restaurant manager Parker Baggett says buying fresh meat and produce from local farmers rekindles a sense of community that often gets lost in the modern world.
You know, we're out here in a rural setting, and, you know, we just believe in sort of stepping back in time. We're not doing anything hip or trendy. It's about slowing things down and doing it an old-fashioned kind of way.
Take me as I am, or let me go. White lilies never grow on stalks of clover. As I am, or let me go.
As Gary Schiebler and Jan Howard and a band of veteran sidemen wade into their final set, a mix of rock and country classics, I realize the fish songs are a red herring. This night isn't about fishing so much as it's about storytelling and nostalgia. During a break, Schiebler casts about for folks in the crowd who've got a fish tale to share.
I guess my fondest fishing memory is fishing at my granddaddy's pond.
My fondest fishing memory got to be going to Alaska with my dad.
Just went and stood on the bank early one morning, mist just rising up off the water. It was a beautiful sunrise.
Flew in on a float plane, spent 2 days out there, and we actually more or less got skunked.
And we fished over the dam. That's where I caught my first fish.
And had never been bass fishing in my life. And I threw that thing out there and caught bass after bass after bass.
Caught one salmon. We grilled that up, and it was the best salmon I've ever had.
And that was my favorite fishing memory.
And I've been hooked ever since. That's my favorite fishing memory.
Oh, the nights I cried. How I died inside. No one will never.
As the night spools out, it finally dawns on Schiebler what it is that connects the parallel threads of songwriting and fishing in his life. It's about anticipation, mystery, and hope. It's the feeling that the next song or the next cast is going to bring that one big hit.
You never know. It could turn on a dime. You could be out on the water fishing all day and not get a bite, and then all of a sudden you hook something and it's a fish of a lifetime.
I'm still hoping to tie into another big bass like my first one, or write the next bestseller. I'm thinking Eat, Pray, Fish. Until then, I'm Kim Green, stringing for Only a Game in Whites Creek, Tennessee.
It's the Thursday night fishing club. Ain't no dues or fees. The miss got brand new carpets, so wipe them shoes off if you please. Meet Dry Sack Jack, Slippery Pete, and maybe Jerry Reed. The Thursday night fishing club, pretty good company.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Mark Filippino. We had help from Emiko Tamagawa. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Kim Green's Thursday Night Fishing Club photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, or listen to archived shows and stories, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Watson, who loved this year's Super Bowl haiku so much that he has submitted one of his own.
Beware, human bards. A grand new intelligence now writes the poems.
Not a single reference to the Super Bowl. What a hack. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
You meet Dry Sack Jack, Jimmy Johnson, and maybe Jerry Reed. Thursday night, fishing club, pretty good company. The Thursday night, fishing club, pretty good company.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at mecfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.